Welcome back to the show. I'm Dara Kennedy. Our guest today isn't just a concerned resident throwing her name in the political ring. She is a mother who battled the pandemic just like her Bay State neighbors. She is a highly regarded political theorist who, as she tells us in this Monday conversation, believes the Constitution belongs to each and every one of us. And for history's sake, she is trying to diversify the state on the highest level. And another thing goes behind the headlines today with Dr. Danielle Allen.
I'm Maya Schwader. Only about 9% of Massachusetts's population identifies as Black, and around 80% is white. That's according to the latest data from the U.S. Census Bureau. This begs the question, is Massachusetts ready for a Black governor? What if that Black governor was also a woman? We'll explore this question with Dr. Allen later in the show. Since she is a newcomer to the political arena, and another thing, sat down with Allen to talk about her inspiration to run, her policy positions, and what Massachusetts needs to know about her. We started by asking, why try to run now?
It really is the pandemic that has brought me to this run for governor. I had such a huge sense of shock when it first hit. I couldn't believe how quickly some people were just willing to imagine abandoning others. You'll remember even that loose talk about older people, you know, it's just their time. Let's just keep the economy open. We don't need to worry about protecting them. I just couldn't believe it. So I jumped in. I did a huge amount of COVID response work, worked at all levels, federal, state, municipal, county. And as I did that work, it just was very clear to me how different the experiences are in our Commonwealth for people in the knowledge economy and people in the services sector. Some people just got to roll up the drawbridge, start telecommuting and ride the pandemic out. The bottom dropped out from under for other people. And that experience, that disparity, you know, that's been building for a long time. It's not new. It didn't just happen this past winter, but this is the moment for making a change, for reimagining ourselves as one Commonwealth, pulling ourselves together, reinvesting in our communities, knitting our communities back together again.
You've had an absolutely stellar, intimidating academic career so far. You have not had any public service roles that you've run for or taken on before. This is the first public service role that you will be campaigning for. What do you say to your lack of experience? How do you think your academic experience might have prepared you for this?
So this is for sure the first elective office I'm running for, but I've done a lot of public service in a lot of ways over time. So I have been fortunate to lead organizations at all scales, from startups to $6 billion philanthropies. In the startup category, I've started a civic education provider here in Massachusetts that delivers curriculum to 14 districts and supports educators in a lot more districts than that. It's not an elective office. It's not a civil service job. I do believe it's public service. Ditto leading $6 billion philanthropy, which invested in education for incarcerated people, which invested in community colleges around the nation, that invested in strengthening arts in communities as a part of empowering communities. Again, not an elective role to be sure, but public service. So I think it's really important that we all recognize that public service comes in a whole lot of forms. And I bring 20 years of public service to this effort.
Well, you launched this exploratory kind of run back in December. And then you went on a series of what you called Commonwealth conversations with residents. What did you learn from these conversations?
I have this view that we have settled for too little in the Commonwealth, that we need to raise our expectations. We've accepted the idea that sort of prosperity is clustering, you know, in eastern Massachusetts, and, you know, young people are moving away from Western Mass, moving away from the Cape because of lack of opportunity. And all over the Commonwealth, our economy is basically being strangled by lack of accessible, affordable housing and by transportation issues. I believe we shouldn't settle for that. We should raise our expectations. And so the question was, you know, do other people think that? You know, is that a feeling around the Commonwealth more broadly? I needed to check that. And then I needed to learn from other people's experiences. You know, I had great conversations with people in the hill towns, with people in, you know, Holyoke and Northampton, people who are trying to do things like reimagine safety, reimagine alternative dispatch systems, people thinking about policing, people thinking about our food systems, how we can connect people better to healthy lifestyles by supporting their efforts to grow things, to raise animals even, and the like. So that I had a lot to learn about what was really on people's minds. And so that was really the purpose of the listening tour. But it has confirmed my initial hunch that we are at a moment where transformation is possible.
If you're just joining us, we are spending our whole show today talking to Dr. Danielle Allen. She is a highly lauded Harvard professor of ethics and political theory, and she just announced that she is running for governor of Massachusetts. Now, despite being an experienced academic and a leader in the startup and nonprofit sectors, she is a political novice. Before her announcement, as we heard, she held a listening tour around the state to test the waters, and we asked her whether there was any particular conversation during that time that really stuck out to her.
Oh my gosh, there have been so many such conversations. It's just been extraordinary and powerful and moving. Now, I mean, we did one session with people who are advocates in the disability community, and just hearing a parent say, you know, I live with this horrible recognition that there's a part of me that is just terrified that I will die before my child, and then what happens to my child? And, you know, the sort of the fear that comes with that, and the fact that we don't have basic structures, foundations for security for people with disabilities, for instance. And that was a very powerful moment. Or I mentioned, you know, one conversation with folks from the Hilltowns where an older person said, you know, I can't find anybody to shovel snow for me in the winter anymore. I feel trapped here and at risk because all the young people have moved away. So the sense of a kind of connection between lack of opportunity for young people and actually our pretty weak structure of elder care in this state. We rank pretty low among states in the country for elder care.
You mentioned that the pandemic was the last straw for you, that you had a profound sense of betrayal in the first few months of COVID-19. Tell us about that.
Yes. So, you know, here we were watching this crisis unfold, and I could see that we had the capacity, especially here in Massachusetts with our biotech sector, to really deliver for the whole nation if we could move fast to scale up testing and contact tracing. So I pulled together, you know, a big network of people to make that case, advocate for that, to try to speed up the work our state was doing, to try to speed up the federal government. And then just, we met with incredible frustration at all those points. Lots of people were ready to go. People were ready to invest in labs faster to build out capacity. And we couldn't generate the political will to make that happen. But the truth is, you know, when I experienced that sense of shock last winter, I mean, that honestly is building on many years of a sense of things being wrong in our communities and in our society. For me, you know, my first sort of movement toward public service, really engagement in advocacy and political campaigning and the like, was brought about by the loss of my cousin. I lost my baby cousin, Michael, in 2009. He had been imprisoned at the age of 15 on a first arrest for an attempted carjacking. He served 12 years. And then when he got out, I always described myself as, I was the cousin on duty. I was the cousin who was helping with housing and school and jobs. And then 2 years after he was first released, he was killed by somebody he met while he was in prison. That was just, as you might imagine, just a devastating moment for my whole family. Hard for me. I had a real strong sense of personal failure. But it was also a real moment for digging in and taking stock and asking a question about, you know, why is it as a society we are doing such a bad job of helping so many young people make a transition to a healthy adulthood, and especially young men of color? So that's the point at which I started diving into justice reform. I became an advocate for cannabis legalization and other aspects of taking apart the war on drugs. That led me to the belief that we couldn't get a lot of important work done unless we had a healthier democracy with full voice and representation for everybody. So that led me to dive into democracy reform. So I've been, you know, working on these issues outside of the academy over an extended period of time. And then when the pandemic hit, it was just, it all came together, sort of failure of governance, the failure of the powerful to see their own responsibilities for our whole society, the fact that many people who feel powerless seem so disconnected from their own agency, and a real just sense of a need to change that fundamental dynamic.
In one of your speeches, I think 3 or 4 years ago, you said that Americans cannot talk about equality. So what is equality to you, and how do you convince the Commonwealth that you will fight for equality?
So the good news is that since I gave that talk, I think actually the dynamic has changed. I think our ability to talk about equality is improving. It really makes me really happy to say that. It's really important that equality comes in a number of different kinds. You know, there's political equality. Do people have full voice and representation? Are they participating? We still have a lot lower turnout rates for African Americans, Asian Americans, Latinx Americans in Massachusetts than for white Americans. We need to get to a place where we really have universal participation, where everybody is participating at the same rates. The pandemic policies around voting were fantastic. They really did increase participation. We need to make those permanent and continue to build out the supports for that universal participation. So that political equality piece is really fundamental. And I believe if you layer that in, then you end up with a political system that also delivers more egalitarian policy along economic dimensions, along social dimensions. So these pieces have to fit together in that way.
Our Monday conversation with gubernatorial candidate and Harvard professor Dr. Danielle Allen will continue with her renewed outlook on equality and what it means for the Commonwealth voter. Stay with us.
You're listening to New England Public Media. There's been no shortage of supply chain shortages during the pandemic. Coming up on Marketplace, we'll tell you why the global supply chains are fragile and how things might be changing to improve them. That's ahead at 6:30 on New England Public Media and on your smart speaker. And another thing on NEPM is funded by you. And Eversource, providing home energy assessments, energy-saving products, and custom recommendations to help save money and energy. More information at eversource.com. Mostly cloudy, breezy, and continued humid tonight with a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms. We'll have patchy fog overnight as well with lows in the upper 50s. Partly sunny and less humid and cooler tomorrow with a 50% chance of showers. Highs in the upper 70s. You're listening to New England Public Media.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Dara Kennedy. There are only 9 women chief executive officers of our United States, and not one is African American. As we rejoin our Monday conversation with Dr. Danielle Allen, she focuses on what equality looks like today and recounts the times that Massachusetts has led the way throughout history.
We need to get to a place where we really have universal participation, where everybody is participating at the same rate.
In one of your speeches, I think 3 or 4 years ago, you said that Americans cannot talk about equality. So what is equality to you, and how do you convince the Commonwealth that you will fight for equality?
So the good news is that since I gave that talk, I think actually the dynamic has changed. I think our ability to talk about equality is improving. It really makes me really happy to say that. It's really important that equality comes in a number of different kinds. You know, there's political equality. Do people have full voice and representation? Are they participating? We still have a lot lower turnout rates for African Americans, Asian Americans, Latinx Americans in Massachusetts than for white Americans. The pandemic policies around voting were fantastic. They really did increase participation. We need to make those permanent and continue to build out the supports for that universal participation. So that political equality piece is really fundamental.
You've talked in the past about how you've been an advisor to other leaders around the country, mayors, governors, presidents. Is there a common mistake that you saw a lot of them making that you have learned from and will do your best to avoid?
Well, you know, I think there is a common mistake that many leaders make and that all good leaders succeed at avoiding, in all honesty. And I think that is really about being clear about helping people find shared purpose. That means sometimes stepping back and recalibrating what the core overarching goal is from an ethical point of view. So I'll just give you a small example from the COVID experience. Part of the reason our decision-making was so bad in COVID is that we settled into this idea that we had to have a trade-off between protecting health and protecting the economy. So there's just this sort of starting assumption that there was a trade-off. Nobody ever stopped to say, well, what is our overarching objective? Okay, you know, we need to protect health, we need to protect the economy, and we need to protect our civil liberties. Is there a way of aligning those goals?
We know that you spearheaded Harvard's COVID-19 initiative, and then you also have criticized the Biden-Harris handling and Governor Baker's response. What do you think they got wrong?
So I spearheaded a COVID rapid response group that was a big network of academics from many institutions anchored in the center that I lead at Harvard. It was a network I built anchored in the center that I lead at Harvard. And I did criticize Governor Baker's response. I criticized the Trump response. So I'm actually quite proud of the fact that actually one of President Biden's first executive orders was to create a pandemic testing board, which was a policy that we developed last April. We tried to convince the Trump administration to adopt it. Ultimately, they didn't adopt it, but the Biden-Harris team did adopt it. So in terms of here in our Commonwealth, there are a couple, I think, of really important mistakes early on. We needed fast, much more intensive investment in Western Massachusetts, for example. We could have kept COVID out of Western Massachusetts. There wasn't a lot of COVID in Western Mass in the very, very beginning. And if the state had been willing to invest in testing sites in Western Massachusetts, we could have just really more or less protected this whole part of the state from COVID in the first place.
I just had a follow-up to that about the COVID response. Did you not like the way that he handled the vaccine distribution, Governor Baker?
So I think that is a good example too. You know, we got off to a super rocky start with vaccine distribution, and what turned the tide? Advocacy turned the tide. Advocacy from grassroots, from community organizations. Now there are two really critical pieces of work, the Berkshire County COVID Collaborative, the Black Boston COVID Coalition. Both cases, networks of, in one case, nonprofits in Boston, health clinics in the Berkshires, found the right level of site for community vaccination clinics that were accessible, connected to people, were able to communicate with communities to get people to vaccine appointments and the like. In other words, it was a great idea. It was a sort of no-brainer in a sense once these ideas were developed, but that was not the kind of receptivity that they got in the first instance from the state government.
Is it your view that policy initiatives should come from the people, or should the government be leading these sorts of things forward?
Well, that is a beautiful question. Thank you for that. It's about partnership. That's the important thing. So it is about people coming together, working together, thinking, learning together, acting together. That is fundamental. And you know, we the people built our state governments in the first place then to deliver for us, to secure for us, deliver the safety and happiness that we are giving definition to.
Well, that's a good point you just make. Following up on that, one of the biggest problems facing Massachusetts is affordable housing, right? And probably more pressing than that even is the transit system. What's your plan to help straighten some of this out and get people back to moving equally and fairly?
Well, you know, these things are just really tightly linked to each other. I think our lack of abundant affordable housing and the insufficiency of our transportation system are kind of strangling our economy, honestly, and really locking opportunity, especially in parts of the Commonwealth outside of the Boston area. So there's West-East Rail, you know, that's something that we should be working on for sure. And regional public transportation. I think we need to strengthen our regional transportation authorities, for instance. But more importantly, even pull all these pieces into an overall strategic plan for the Commonwealth. We have a state administration, the Baker-Polito administration, is pretty incrementalist in its approach. But transportation is not a kind of issue that you can tackle in an incremental way.
We are in conversation with Danielle Allen, who officially announced her campaign to run for governor last week. While it may seem hard to believe as you listen to her now, next she tells us that, in fact, she grew up a conservative Republican. I came across one of your speeches at the Howenstein Center for Presidential Studies, and you were again speaking about the Declaration of Independence. What is it about that particular piece of work that you love so much?
Oh my goodness, you're going to get me going with that one. Alrighty. Okay, I just have to give you the second sentence of the Declaration, okay? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principle and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Okay, that's a super long sentence. Most people don't really realize it's that long. They think it just starts after these individual rights, this sort of pursuit of happiness. That's not where it ends. It goes all the way through to the idea that we build our government to secure our safety and happiness together. All right, so that's what I love about the Declaration of Independence. It just teaches us in this really quick way what our political institutions are supposed to do. It is the message for me that's really connected to this idea that we should reimagine ourselves as one commonwealth.
We have an interesting moment in the Commonwealth right now where you have emerged as a gubernatorial candidate, and all of the front runners for Boston mayor right now are all people of color. Mm-hmm. What do you think that says about where the Commonwealth is right now in terms of equity?
I think we're at a breakthrough moment for sure. And it's true. I quote the sentence as it was written to remind people of that history, to remind people of the transition that we're making. At the same time, it's really important to recognize that one of the people who helped draft that sentence was John Adams in our state. So John Adams never owned slaves. He thought enslavement was a bad thing. And indeed, he drafted our state constitution. He took that language of the Declaration of Independence right into the state constitution. And that language was the basis for the first abolition of enslavement in the country, which happened here in Massachusetts in 1783. And so I like to say, look, you know, we are a leadership state. We led by being the first state to abolish enslavement. We led by inventing public schools. We led by inventing public health infrastructure. And much more recently, you know, we are the first state to legalize marriage equality and the first state to lay a foundation for universal access to healthcare, high quality healthcare. We're not leading at the moment, you know, we're kind of stumbling along and thinking it's okay just to sort of have a status quo and think we just need a manager in the governor's office. I think we can lead in terms of defining what it means to knit our communities back together by investing in civic and social infrastructure.
Those are very liberal words. You grew up in a conservative Republican family. Are you a former conservative?
You know, I mean, I haven't been since college, basically. My junior year of college was my turning point. I had an internship that summer at a conservative magazine and found myself just in great disagreement with other people in the editorial room on issues of income inequality, for example, which were just starting to rise to the surface. So, yep, that's how I was raised, and it's been a different place for me since about 1992.
What's your sense of the Republican Party right now?
I think the Republican Party is in a bad way and doing damage to our country. So I think it's really important to separate the party as an organization from voters.
If we were interviewing your family and friends, what would they say about you, and what do you want voters to know about you, Danielle Allen?
Oh, gosh. Oh, my goodness. Okay, thank you. You got me with that question. If you were interviewing family and friends, I think they would tell you that Danielle is passionate, that Danielle cares, that Danielle works ridiculously hard. And I think that they would tell you that I also like a laugh. I like a good joke. My son memorized, you know, all the jokes in like all the volumes of Calvin and Hobbes during the pandemic. And so that has been one of our silver linings of the past year.
Thank you to gubernatorial candidate Dr. Danielle Allen for joining our Monday conversation. A reminder, you may leave comments at 800-639-9120. I'm Dara Kennedy. Thank you for tuning in.
You can follow us on social media. We are at Hello and Another, or you can email us at andanotherthing@nepm.org. I'm Maya Schwader. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.